In the last few years, the middle class has dwindled, and the gulf between the very rich and everybody else has increased. Today, the current generation isn't so sure it's guaranteed to be moving up like its parents did. In fact, even a yearly income of $100,000 might not guarantee a well-feathered nest. Hi, I'm Veronica Rickard, keeping you company today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, whatever happened to the middle class? Will the Democrats create a new deal? And what constitutes middle class these days anyway? Is it a social class or is it a state of mind? Our guest this hour is Julian Zelizer. He teaches history and public affairs at Princeton University. We'll be talking about his article, A New Social Contract, from the Washington Post that ran June 22nd of this year. I hope you'll join us this hour as well. Do you think the middle class could use another big boost from the government, FDR style? Are we ready for the government to hold the umbrella again when the rain comes down? Or is big government still out of style? The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Julian Zelizer, thanks so much for joining us this hour.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you know what they say, before you can know where you are, you have to know where you've been. So let's talk about the last times a Democrat has succeeded in these sort of sweeping social reforms to help the working and middle class.
Well, the two great examples, the first was in the 1930s with Franklin Roosevelt and the Great Depression, and we saw all kinds of new social programs, from legitimizing unions, which created the economic base for a new middle class, to Social Security, which became the way we protect the elderly. And then in the 1960s was the next great burst with Lyndon Johnson and the Great Society. There we saw programs such as Medicare, which is our major form of provision of health care for the elderly, to other kinds of educational and environmental programs which came of age, as well as civil rights in the 1960s.
So these programs, have they really sort of aided, and in ways, is it safe to say that they created the middle class?
Yeah, I think they were quite important. I mean, we had a middle class in the United States developed because of the economy, but it expands vastly during the 1930s, and part of what happens is the government creates certain kinds of supports that allows industrial workers in the United States to enjoy new kinds of economic success. So it's because of the government that unions are allowed to survive in the 1930s, and unions become a vehicle for many workers, many immigrants, to start enjoying the benefits of home ownership, of steady, stable employment. During the 1940s, FDR provides GI benefits to returning veterans, and that is often the reason many people go to college for the first time in their family. Without government, all these pillars of the middle class that would define the 20th century might very well not have existed.
Well, what are we talking about today when we talk about the middle class? You mentioned going to school, buying a house, joining a union. What does it still mean the same stuff today, or is it something different?
I think it's different. I mean, in this article that I wrote with Michael Kazin, the thing we pointed out is now the challenge is not so much creating or expanding a middle class, it's literally protecting middle class families. There's a sense that stability, which many Americans had throughout since the 1930s, is no longer there. A lot of the supports government provided are weakened or they're not even in existence anymore. And many younger people aren't sure that they're going to go up the ladder economically like their parents and their grandparents enjoyed. What's the middle class? I think, you know, it's always very hard to define, but there's a certain amount of economic security that one can have where one's job doesn't depend necessarily on kind of a day-to-day existence, certain kind of annual or biannual security, and certain goods we look for, including home ownership and protection in terms of pensions and health care, that I think tend to constitute what we think of when we think of a middle-class citizen.
Well, and in terms of what constitutes middle class, there are several books and other sources out right now that talk about, you know, people who earn over $100,000 or thereabouts still consider themselves middle class and maybe not even cutting it very well.
Right. Again, it's very hard to define. Some people say, you know, if you're not rich enough to not work, you're still part of the middle class. And if you don't have certain kinds of, you know, economic supports like a trust fund that some Americans enjoy, generally your income sustains you, that you gain from work. And that's kind of a very rough, loose way to think of what a middle-class citizen is. And at the same time, though, you have to have enough money that you're not just kind of surviving hour to hour, and you have certain forms of security. I think that's been what the middle class has been about in the 20th century, that you have a certain amount of health care security, you have a certain amount of security when you retire, that you won't be broke and just dependent on your family, that you have some security that your children can be educated. I think the security often helped by government is part of how we thought, at least, of the middle class until recently.
It's interesting, because I can remember in the not-so-distant past, people talked about breaking six figures, and that used to be, you know, the sign that you had made it, you had arrived. And like you're talking about, it's a lot more ambiguous now, and it's more about security than about salary.
Yeah, and part of it is, you know, as the middle class expanded in the 20th century, people bought more goods, and the expectations of what people needed to have in terms of the size of their house, the kind of car they drove, the kind of education their children received, that also increased. And there's clearly a cultural element to being middle class and to who is middle class, and you want to live up to certain standards of what your neighbor does or what your friends do. And so I think there's kind of a ratcheting up effect in terms of what you need to be in this social strata.
Do you think that the middle class as a whole is worried? I know there's kind of a glut of books out. In fact, we interviewed an author last week, I think it was, maybe 2 weeks ago, the author of High Wire, talking about how the safety net has been pulled from American families in terms of government protections. But do you think this is sort of an isolated phenomenon that sort of goes family by family, or is the middle class as a general, are they feeling it right now?
No, I think there's a lot of evidence at this point that the middle class is feeling it, and it's not just a result of the Bush years. I think in the last, you know, 10, 15, even 20 years, we've seen a gradual squeeze and an increasing amount of pressure on middle-class families. You know, some of the benefits that they need or expected, such as health care, are becoming more costly, and for some of them are becoming a luxury rather, or something that's scarce rather than something that they have that they're entitled to. There's a lot of fear about pensions. You know, for many decades, most Americans in the middle class kind of expected, you know, when they retired, there would be government support for them. There'd be corporate pensions for them for where they worked. They no longer have that. Jobs, middle-class jobs, are no longer as stable. I mean, as the global economy took form and you know, unionization diminished, there was more movement, more firing, more layoffs, and that basic stability that when you wake up, your job will probably be there if you're doing good work is no longer there for many Americans. And now what we've seen in the last few years is kind of a squeeze in terms of inflation on issues such as energy and food, and that combined with lacking these other supports, I think, has really squeezed a lot of middle-class citizens.
Well, as we've been talking about, you know, we've gone from FDR trying to creating really the middle class and then growing the middle class, and now we're talking about protecting the middle class, which I assume is why most voters are most concerned about the economy. Where is this going to head in terms of the middle class? What can they expect from the different candidates in the upcoming election?
Well, I mean, the two candidates on these issues in terms of how do you protect the middle class family from all these insecurities that have emerged, whether it's inflation or whether it's the way jobs are structured in the global economy, I think the two candidates differ. That's an area there's some differences. John McCain has generally on economic policy moved toward where the Bush administration was. His kind of biggest shift is defending the Bush tax cuts, which were skewed toward the wealthiest Americans and not the broad middle class. And it's premised on an argument that tax cuts for the wealthy kind of sustain the overall health of the economy. And if you have a healthy economy, you have a healthy middle class. That's kind of the argument. That's a Reagan argument. That's an argument that came out of conservatism in the 1970s. And John McCain has embraced it now. And so what you're going to see from him primarily involves tax cuts. Even his health care plan revolves around tax credits for people to buy health insurance and to create competition in the markets. I think Barack Obama and the Democrats are supporting a much more aggressive vision of government intervention to try to shore up these middle class problems. And there's many issues we discussed in the post. One is a kind of tax credit for paying for education, to help finance education, to really kind of elaborate program for national health care, which doesn't create a new government insurance market, but would help subsidize Americans who don't have health care. So on health care, on education, on the home mortgages, the Democrats are putting forth a number of different kinds of government interventions, they're proposing at least, to deal with these insecurities.
Is the Republican philosophy on economics, as you described it, in the lineage that goes down to John McCain, is that still being described as trickle-down economics, or is that a passé term?
It's a passé term, but it's a very current way of thinking. That's still basically the argument that we've heard through the Bush administration. It's still very popular in Republican circles. And John McCain, who didn't actually support, he was a critic of trickle-down economics in the last few years, has now embraced it. And so I think it still very much defines how the Republicans argue about economic policy. If you protect the wealthiest, if you protect corporations through tax cuts, that improves the overall health of the economy. It improves everyone's well-being. And that's, I think, a central claim. And that's something we're going to hear from John McCain.
Do you have a sense of how that's gone over with the public, whether there is a verdict in on so-called trickle-down economics, whether it works or not?
Well, there's two different parts of that argument. I mean, I think there's a lot of evidence that it doesn't work, but that's primarily from academics and pundits. And I think there's always a certain amount you see in these polls of skepticism that the public hears this and they basically say the wealthy are going to get the tax cuts. At the same time, you know, Republicans have done quite well with this argument. It's been the anti-communism argument of the 1990s and the early 2000s, meaning kind of the unifying Republican argument. We're all in favor of tax cuts. And I think at a gut level, many Americans, even if they know it's not exactly true, just still like politicians who are more likely to cut taxes in general, even if it's not going to be their taxes. There's also an argument of a more devious side, that Republicans argue everyone will get tax cuts, and that's what Bush argued in 2001 with his first tax cut in 2003, when in fact most people don't get tax cuts. So on the one hand, there's this kind of idea that Americans just like tax cuts, even if they're not getting them. They basically favor that outlook of government. And the second argument is that Republicans have been quite good at presenting tax cuts that actually benefit a very small portion of the population as tax cuts that will benefit a broad portion of the population.
Do you think that the next election is going to be about the middle class?
Yeah, I do. I think, you know, national security is still an issue, and it's still an important issue. I think we tend to suggest it's gone away. But when we're dealing with the economy, I think that's the big, other than immigration, that's the big question out there. It's a question that's in a lot of Americans' minds. I mean, if you see the polls, if you read the interviews, we are now in an anxious era. And many Americans no longer feel the security that they had or their families had for many decades. I think the housing crisis becomes one very concrete symbol of that anxiety. Americans are scared that their most valuable investment and really the symbol of middle-class citizenship in America, that the value of that investment can rapidly diminish to the point of economic peril. And when those kinds of issues are what are being discussed in not only in polls but around the workplace and in the homes, I think you have a problem that is going to be central in the election.
We're talking this hour with Julian Zelizer. He teaches history and public affairs at Princeton University. He's also the author of the article, A New Social Contract, which ran recently in the Washington Post. Well, what do you think? Do you think the middle class is in dire need of another boost from the government? And who do you think is best equipped to deliver that boost to the middle class? The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, and we hope to hear from you this hour. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert with you today on the Ideas Network, and we're talking about the middle class. It has declined in recent years. The number of people who are middle class have dwindled, and those who remain feel less secure than they once did. So we're wondering this hour whether the middle class needs a boost from the government, and if we're looking for it in the next election, if we're looking for a boost from the government, who's more likely to deliver, John McCain or Barack Obama? We're talking with Julian Zelizer. He teaches history and public affairs at Princeton University. Hope you'll join our conversation this hour at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And Julian Zelizer, let's go over to the phones. We've got a call here from Mike in Langlade County. Hi, Mike.
Good morning.
Morning.
I would like to point out that the middle class has shrunk because of both parties' actions in Washington. And just for a couple examples, every single state in the Union used to have a usury law. Now, that prevented excess interest charges. In Wisconsin, the rate was 12%. There were only two states in the entire country that had a different usury rate. When banks wanted to go into national banking, the entire Congress caved in to their request to eliminate state usury laws because they didn't want to be, quote, governed by 50 different laws regulating the amount of interest they could charge. Nobody had the sense to say what should be the federal usury rate. Congress caved in and eliminated state usury laws, and now you have situations like credit cards are all commonly up in the 19, 20, 25%, the payday loan companies are charging 500 and 600%. If I, on my Social Security and pension direct deposit to my bank, want to take an advance on next month's check, that costs me 120% per annum, which is why I don't do it. And that was just utterly stupid. But the point is, Congress caved in and eliminated the usury laws. Now, that's one thing that's got to come back. We have to have a federal usury law that caps interest at some decent rate. The next thing is the estate tax, the federal estate tax, in actuality, in some cases, was more or less confiscatory because the tax rate used to be 55% of what got taxed. A lot of people never paid any attention that the marital deduction was allowed up to one half of the adjusted gross estate, no matter how big it was. For the first spouse to die, could leave to the opposite spouse one half of their adjusted gross estate, which might be in the millions or even billions without taxes. At the death of the second spouse, there was only a $675,000 exemption, and then the rest of the estate got taxed at 55%. That was the only rate. It wasn't progressive. What do the people want to do? Eliminate the estate tax entirely. Now, it only hits 0.2% of all the estates that are filed in the whole blooming country. But if your mother's rich, you better knock her off before 2010, because right now there isn't any estate tax. After 2010, we go back to the old law.
All right. Thanks a lot, Mike. And Julian Zelizer, what do you think? Do you think those two points that Mike brought up are those key pieces to this puzzle?
Yeah, they're parts of the puzzle. I mean, I think both reflect bigger issues. So the usury laws, I think, touch on the problem of credit and debt, which isn't something we didn't talk about earlier. But I think, you know, part of the squeeze is not just the structure of the workplace, but it's the higher and higher levels of debt that many middle-class Americans are living under, whether it's through purchases on the credit card, as he was talking about, or through purchases of a home. And they're kind of bearing down on many, many Americans. So that's one area where we have seen kind of bipartisan movement away from the kinds of regulations that might be helpful to deal with this crisis. And it's certainly not always a Republican versus Democratic problem, but that's certainly a key area. And the estate tax, I think, is just part of a broader movement away from progressivity that we've seen since Ronald Reagan. The progressive tax code, whether it's the estate tax or the income tax has been gutted in terms of its progressivity. And I think that's a big question that's now on the table. It's not just about do we want more taxes or less taxes. How progressive should the code be? Who should it hit? Who should pay for it? I would just add, in addition to the estate tax and these issues, we have to talk about the Social Security tax, which tends to hit average workers, middle-class workers, much harder than it hits the wealthy. And that's a very regressive tax that also needs to be part of the mix. But debt and taxes, I think, are two central issues. Often they're hard for voters to follow, but given the kinds of problems middle-class citizens are facing, I think there's an immediacy to them right now that can be used to make them discussions in this campaign.
All right, let's go back to the phones again, and here's Zach calling from Green Bay. Hi, Zach, you're on the air.
Thank you. I just wanted to somewhat challenge the idea that activist government is linked to the middle-class safety net and laissez-faire government is linked to our current extremely wealthy safety net, if you want to call it that.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I say that is since 1980, the government has been very active in changing policies, changing laws, changing tax policy, changing health care policy, spending policies having to do with education, military, et cetera, changing regulation policy, energy policy. All of these have been active changes pursued by the government, because of pressure by lobbyists, et cetera, and they have resulted in basically the current welfare state for the extremely wealthy. I think it is ironic that it was the voting of the middle class who is now suffering who actually voted for the politicians that facilitated these changes, and I think it is very frightening and ironic that in the current upcoming presidential race, another candidate who wants to continue the policies that are going to continue to destroy the middle class may very well win again because of middle-class voting and the fear of guns, God, and gays.
All right. Thanks a lot, Zach. Julian Zelizer?
That's an interesting argument, and it's certainly there's a validity to what Zach said in that, we often talk about, liberals for government, conservatives against government, or Democrats for government, Republicans against it. But I think now we have a more sophisticated understanding that, Republicans support government too. And we've seen a vast expansion of government and a reordering of our priorities since 2001 when President Bush started his presidency. And part of what that included was a shift of government assistance to certain industries or to certain higher income groups rather than the idea that we eliminated government altogether. So it's not just about taking government supports away from the middle class. It's also about giving government support to other parts of the country. The subsidies to the oil industry is one of the most talked about examples of where President Bush used the power of government to help an entire industry despite all the rhetoric about curtailing the size of Washington. So I think that is important. I mean, some people talk about reordering priorities, and I think that's a good way to think about it rather than one party being against government and the other for it. And so now part of the debate will be about, do you take subsidies, do you take tax breaks back from people who have received them since 2001 and then give them back to middle-class citizens? John McCain is standing by the tax cuts of President Bush. Barack Obama is actually calling to reverse some of them and then use that money to give it to lower-income workers. So that's exactly the debate we're talking about right now.
Well, that rhetoric about big government, that has been around a long time, and it's been nipping at the ankles of the Democrats for a long time, too. How are we going to see that rhetoric redirected in terms of what big government is?
Well, it's important. I mean, it is a danger. It would be, I think, a little dangerous for Barack Obama and Democrats in Congress to simply try to rekindle the kind of rhetoric of 1930s America. The conservative movement had an impact on America. I think it did impact many Americans and how they think of what government could or could not do. It raised questions about the benefits of markets over bureaucracies. So I think as Democrats support new kinds of interventions to help sustain and protect and stabilize middle-class life, they have to be careful because they're going to be attacked as being big government tax and spend liberals. And they're going to have to be a little Clintonian, meaning Bill Clintonian, in terms of how do you package government programs so they don't just sound like traditional forms of big government. And you know, healthcare is one place where you'll see, I'm sure, Barack Obama wrestle with this challenge.
So you don't think that term has been gutted? It's still got teeth.
Oh, it has teeth, yes. I mean, I do think it's a very powerful argument. It's like being weak on defense. It's just a powerful argument on the campaign trail. And, you know, a Republican who supports primarily tax cuts for the rich can still warn average working constituents that you're going to get taxed more, and that scares them. And again, the Reagan Revolution, the conservative revolution, was a big, big event in American life. Its public debate's been reshaped in the last 30 years. And so I think Democrats need to be careful. They don't just have to propose new kinds of government intervention, but they have to pay close attention in the next few months, if they want to win, to how they frame these issues, how they discuss these issues, how they express their cognizance that government is not automatically good, that we have to be cautious about how we use government, but at the same time show that government intervention can still be very useful to the economic benefit of the country.
Okay, let's go on and take another phone call. We've got Bill on the line from Milwaukee. Welcome, Bill.
Good morning, Veronica.
Good morning.
Well, it's been all this infernal union busting since the beginning of 1947 with the amendments to the National Labor Relations Act, the Taft-Hartley amendments, and the creation of a dual labor state in this nation, where you have basically half of this nation, the southern half, engaging in union busting and union hatred, and then the corporations through Reagan, Bush 1, Clinton, and Bush 2, just continuing the union busting and the union hatred. The only thing that propelled the middle class in this country from the state of the working class were trade unions. And there is absolutely no way that we're going to sustain an economy without the labor movement. And those people that argue for union hatred and union busting should realize that globalization is nothing but more than a shibboleth for union busting.
All right, thanks a lot, Bill. And Julian Zelizer, you do talk about that in your article, how unions have seen a decline as well. Is that something that we're going to see kind of surge again?
Well, yes. I mean, unions were clearly at the heart of the New Deal coalition in the 20th century. They were central to pushing Democrats to embrace these issues about economic justice, and they were key, really, to building support for programs, not just for workers in the workplace, but for programs such as Social Security. When Social Security comes under attack in the 1980s under Reagan, the AFL-CIO is extremely important to defending the program and kind of mobilizing support. So unions have declined. A lot of it's been through aggressive government action against unions. It's also, though, been about shifts in how work is structured and the nature of industry. And so there's been multiple reasons, but unions have clearly been a declining force. We have seen certain areas like public sector unionism, healthcare unionism, where there's been a resurgence of union power. In places like New York, healthcare unions have become extraordinarily powerful, representing kind of janitorial staff and the staffers, as well as nursing unions. And I think, you know, Barack Obama so far has talked a bit about this and has said he would support strengthening unions and arguing that's really a fundamental goal that we need to achieve if we really want to protect workers from the uncertainties we've been talking about. But like reeling against taxes, I think attacking unions is also still a very powerful argument that conservatives have promoted, and many Americans, even those who come from working-class families, accept to some degree that unions are corrupt, that they hurt the workplace. So I think Democrats there, too, need to kind of think of how they talk of supporting unions in fresh ways and talk about, you know, what a new unionism might look like, not just a return to the 30s, 40s, and 50s, but strengthening unions, but new kinds of unions that avoid some of the problems we've seen before.
Well, let's talk about that. How would a new kind of union protect the middle class and the worker?
Well, the key thing that unions obviously have achieved are A, job security, B, you know, through the seniority system in the 50s and 60s, but also certain kinds of benefits for retirement and for health care. So one thing unions will do is press in the workplace, provide a counterforce to employers to not only achieve but to maintain these benefits as the pressures of the economy become great against them. You know, unions also work within the Democratic Party to keep these issues that Hillary Clinton made so central in her campaign, keep them on the agenda. In New York, unions are very powerful. They fund advertisements when a candidate is against the interests of union workers. They can expect very intense advertising campaigns against them in the next election. And that kind of political pressure is something I think that unions can bring to bear on the political scene.
All right, thanks for your call, Bill, and we'll move on to Chad in Wausau. Hello, Chad, you're up.
Hey, this is Chad, and I'm from Michigan, and I'm on my way back there from Minneapolis. 4 points. Number one, I'd like your guest to comment on. My feeling is if we don't do something to restore the middle class, we're going to see more chaos than we ever seen in the civil strife in the 60s. My 3 points. Number one, we need to restore a fair progressive income tax, and I refer to Warren Buffett and Bill Gates on that, who are both for it. Number two, we need to have national health insurance. I reference a doctor who is the head of the medical school at Indiana, or at least on staff, who 5 years ago they did a poll, and 30-some percent of doctors were for national health insurance. Just a few months ago, they've redone the poll, and over 50% of doctors are for national health insurance. Three, we need to move to alternate energy. The worst thing we ever did was when Reagan came into office, he rescinded Carter's tax on oil that was going into alternative energy research. At the same time that that was going on with Carter, the Minister of Energy in Brazil was moving Brazil to renewable energy, and look where Brazil is at today. If we don't do those three things, we are not going to see a middle class again. And I would like for your guest to comment on those, and thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot, Chad. Julian Zelizer?
Yeah, all good points. I think the first point Chad raised on the progressive income tax we've discussed, and we see there's a stark difference where the two candidates stand. Health insurance, I think, you know, that's a big challenge. Health insurance, national health insurance, has failed many times. It failed under Harry Truman when it was proposed. It failed in the early 60s, and it also failed under President Clinton. And so Democrats who want to push an issue that has a lot of support with middle-class voters but seems to get killed when it comes time to push this stuff through Congress need to think of a way to formulate this so they're not subject to those big government socialized medicine kind of attacks we've seen so frequently. So far, Barack Obama is trying to do this. In his proposal, he is not talking about any kind of a national mandate, which was a controversy in the primary, but he's using kind of different ways to expand coverage. He's talking about guaranteeing eligibility to health insurance for all Americans, regardless of their existing conditions. He's talking about mandates for children, an area where usually there's more political support than when you talk about mandates for all Americans. He's talking about trying to push for lower premiums and co-pays. And so I think the Obama campaign is thinking very carefully about that, and he's not making promises yet in his health insurance program that will allow Republicans to kind of use the traditional attacks against him. And so, you know, that is an area where the payoff for success could be huge. I mean, that could be a landmark achievement. The last time we really saw a health care program of national scope was obviously Medicare. So it's possible to get it, but I think the Democrats have to be careful. Energy is another great issue. A lot of middle-class support for alternative energy, for environmentally friendly energy policies. It's often a very complex issue, very hard to get through Congress.
Congress. Republicans have a very kind of powerful electoral argument. They usually make the argument we need more drilling and we need more military in the Persian Gulf. That's their solution, and there's a clarity to that argument that alternative energy does not provide. So I think that's yet another area where Democrats have this issue where maybe more voters are with them than with the GOP, but they have to find a way to present their ideas and focus in on a couple issues where they're not subject to the traditional attacks that we've seen. With energy, the kind of added layer of the national security concerns, I think, offers Democrats and pro-energy independence Republicans, they have an opportunity now to push for something that they haven't had in a while, because many Americans think this is a solution to our national security problems, even if they're not particularly friendly to the environment. And so this is a moment that can be capitalized on.
I'm going to take a quick break right now, and then we'll be back with more of your phone calls. We're talking about the middle class this hour and what can be done to help the struggling middle class. Are we ready to return to maybe bigger government? Do we want to take a lesson from what FDR has done, or is that too much to ask? Is big government still a dirty word? The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. We've got a line for you at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert back with you today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And this hour we're talking about the middle class. The middle class seems to be the biggest player, have the most at stake at least in the next election. And both Barack Obama and John McCain are focusing their attentions on the middle class. But who will serve it best and what needs to be done to put the net under the middle class and help them survive the shakes in the economy? The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. We hope to hear from you, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Julian Zelizer, our guest this hour, he teaches history and public affairs at Princeton University. And we'll take another phone call now. We've got Jeff calling from Burnham Wood. Hello, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning. Thank you. Professor, I was wondering how come defense spending seems to be like such a third rail, just like Social Security. In my view, just about any government spending is socialist. These corporations that get these no-bid contracts for this, they end up making thousands of percent profit, yet they're considered to be more patriotic. Wouldn't you think they'd be more patriotic if they were giving more value for our soldiers and our military instead of actually seeing how much money they can make off of it, which would be added resources that could be available for the middle class and the poor?
I think that's a good point. We've seen this issue with conservatives and with the Republican Party all the way back to the 1940s. There's always been this internal argument in the conservative movement. How do you square massive defense spending and the defense spending that's structured in a way to benefit the defense industry, private contractors, not necessarily for the interests of the soldiers? How do you square that with the anti-government philosophy of the right? And I think we've seen a new version of that argument in the past, in the past administration, where we've had this increase in spending. A lot of defense industries are doing very well through this administration because of the war. And I think that's an open question. And I think it creates a certain amount of unease within the Republican Party and conservative movement that is something Democrats might they don't tend to capitalize on that, or they don't try to offer their own arguments because they're scared to attack the structured defense spending. Instantly, they remember George McGovern. They think of being attacked as weak on defense. But I think it's a very important issue. And in fact, as we've entered this war on terrorism and we have these challenges, it's that much more important. How do we have a rational military budget? What's the relationship between defense spending and contractors? And how do we do this in a way that we assure ourselves of the most efficient military possible, rather than just a system that tends to benefit these corporations? And I think that is a question we should have, and I think it's a question that would probably concern a lot of middle-class Americans, but it's one that's almost off the table because Republicans defend the status quo and Democrats are scared to be seen as weak on defense, including with these middle-class voters we've been talking about.
Well, just to piggyback on that comment, in your article you talk about one of the hurdles of the Democrats who want to probably pass new social programs and social programs that protect the middle class. You talk about one of the major stumbling blocks being that Democrats don't have and haven't traditionally, well, at least for a while, had a cohesive vision for foreign policy. Is that something that you see as perhaps trumping the concerns of the middle class?
I think it's a big problem. It's a big threat. I mean, I think we argue the Democrats generally have come together around this idea of protecting middle-class families and restoring middle-class security. But in foreign policy, they really have not offered a very clear alternative to what we have at this point. I mean, the biggest argument has been about withdrawing from Iraq. So we have the Iraq position more clearly defined. But outside of that, we don't know, you know, what is the Democratic agenda in terms of dealing with terrorism or evaluating the terrorist threat? What is the Democratic agenda for the Middle East and establishing peace in that region? How will we curb nuclear proliferation? There's a series of questions that Democrats have not really talked about, either because they're scared of being attacked or being classified as weak on defense, or because, ironically, there's so much emphasis on the economy right now, they just haven't paid as much attention to that. But it's a vulnerability. I mean, Barack Obama is facing a veteran, he's facing a war hero, and he's facing someone who has a very clearly defined vision of what needs to happen in the international world, and squarely put himself behind the Bush administration. And so I think Democrats need to avoid just leaving that an open question going into the fall. They can't expect that the economy will necessarily still be the major issue or only issue, and they can't expect that Republicans won't attack them even if the economy is the big issue. And so I think that's an area Democrats have been quite weak, and Barack Obama remains extremely vague in terms of how he sees world affairs.
Well, the economy is still number one on voters' minds, but do you see this question of foreign policy as something that could end up looming larger than it seems in the polls?
It could. Obviously, these are polls taken now in June. We don't know what's going to happen, how important the world will look come September and October. We just don't know. I mean, foreign affairs are notoriously unstable and unpredictable, and they're still part of the package that voters will evaluate. Even if economy is number one, if we're talking about a narrow election like we've seen in recent years, you know, this could be an issue that swings voters in a state like Florida sufficiently to turn the election. So Democrats and Republicans, they can't afford to give that one up, even if economy is front and center.
Okay. Well, let's go back to the phones now, and we've got Michelle on the line from Illinois. Hi, Michelle. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I'd like to say that part of the reason that we're losing the middle class is because less quality in manufactured goods today and the disposable. Everything you buy is disposable. It lasts until the warranty runs out, and then it's gone. And my husband's self-employed, and he's going to close down his business because he can't get good parts for the heating and air conditioning equipment that he puts in. And he ends up having to drive back and forth, using up all the profits in gas to fix people's equipment. And when you buy stuff, you end up having to buy it over and over again. You can't get anything to last more than 6 months. So how is anybody supposed to get ahead?
Okay, thanks a lot for your call, Michelle. We appreciate that. And how about consumerism in this piece of the puzzle?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. Those are the kinds of issues that matter, I think, to a lot of voters. Very practical issues, like, you know, whether the goods we buy seem to break down very quickly, so we're constantly having to pay for new ones. To the more well-known is the price of gas, obviously, to other issues we've seen over the year, like the safety of toys for children. That was a huge issue. And often these kind of don't get on onto the campaign trail because candidates have limited time, and especially in presidential races, they focus on the big questions. But I actually think those are the kinds of issues that she just mentioned that either party, whatever your position is, that they can use that to kind of connect these big economic policies you might see on the web page of a Barack Obama to John McCain to the everyday challenges that middle-class families are facing. So it might be see why do goods break down so much, and why do we have to buy the same thing every 2 years rather than buying one thing for 20 years? And that touches on issues, for example, of regulating the production of consumer goods, and what role should the government play in that? They're tied to big policy questions. But I think candidates often forget about this as they get into the heated last months of the campaign. But they are a way to connect what voters are feeling to what politicians are proposing.
Well, thank you for the call, Michelle. And we do have an open line right now, so if you'd like to get in, this is a good time at 1-800-642-1234. That number again is 1-800-642-1234. And let's go and take a phone call now from Steve in Hudson. Hi, Steve, you're up.
Good morning.
Morning.
I think, unfortunately, the middle class and lower class needs to look at itself a bit for our woes. With the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980, this country, and his re-election, this country bought into the idea that markets solve all problems and that absolute free trade is the only way to go. And I think that every time we buy products made in China or other Asian countries where the labor that makes them is paid poverty wages, and the environment, there are no environmental regulations, we just undermine ourselves. Obviously, from a humanitarian standpoint, trade is a great thing, and it does help improve the standing of other people. But when it's so unfair, as it is now, with virtually no environmental regulation and wages being able to be pressed lower and lower, I think the ultimate result is what we're starting to see, and that is it's going to, rather than Reagan's idea that a rising tide lifts all boats, I think the falling wage lowers all, and we see that in outsourcing of all types. In our area up here, airline maintenance has been almost completely outsourced, and all sorts of good-paying jobs have gone away, probably never to return. And I think we need to look at ourselves and start telling the politicians that we don't buy the idea that absolute free trade with zero restriction is going to solve our problems.
All right. Thanks a lot for that call, Steve. And Julian Zelzer, that sort of a trade that Steve is talking about, that's a hard one to dial back at this point. It's become so widespread. What do you think is going to happen there?
Yeah, I think it's very hard to, you know, it would be very hard to try to argue we're not going to have this kind of free trade, this kind of international economy. I just think it's very difficult to reverse. And you know, arguments against that tend to be dismissed quite quickly in the mainstream political realm. At the same time, the new economy has caused a lot of the concerns that we are talking about. So there seems to be, within the Democratic Party certainly, but also within the GOP, support for government to help kind of ameliorate the hardest aspects of this new economy. That's exactly where government support can come in, not necessarily to reverse this kind of economy, but to protect Americans and members of other countries, citizens of other countries, from the worst aspects of it. So health care is not just an issue about Americans being entitled to health care, but it's about a way to sustain worker satisfaction and security in this changing very dynamic economy. And I think, you know, that the Democrats for a while were struggling with this in their primaries. There's a lot of pressure to attack NAFTA, to come out strongly against the new economy. And I think where both Democrats ended up and where they'll remain is kind of a midpoint, where this is exactly what government needs to do now, to create certain protections and regulations to not allow the economy to dominate everything, but to create controls within this new economy.
We had a caller on the line who couldn't stay with us who wanted to bring education into the discussion here. And in terms, at least, about college. I know that Barack Obama, just from his website, he had some plans to make college affordable, simplify the application process, create the American Opportunity Tax Credit, and John McCain says he'll release a more detailed plan in the fall. But what is the middle class looking for in help with education?
There's two levels. I mean, the college education, I think the major issue is cost. It's not about quality. It's not about the structure. I think it comes down to one issue. Cost is very expensive, and I think a lot of Americans are looking for some kind of relief from the expanding costs. They want access. I think with lower education, with education for kids K through 12, that's a more a bigger problem and a bigger set of questions. It's not so much about access, it's about the structure. And No Child Left Behind, which was one of Bush's signature achievements, has become incredibly controversial in terms of, you know, what kinds of standards are being expected, how the standards have restructured education, as well as older concerns about how much money goes to education and what the role of the federal government could be. McCain has been somewhat ambiguous about this, but I do think it's an issue that touches on many Americans. It's, again, one of those kind of gut issues where if a candidate talks about the need to reform something that affects their kids, they can elicit a pretty big reaction. And I suspect No Child Left Behind will be something you hear about on the campaign trail. Barack Obama has called for reforms of that whole system, and it's become kind of a symbol of, for Democrats, how Bush, when he did social policy, he did it badly. And I don't know what McCain's role is going to be at this point. We haven't heard his arguments, but I do think he's going to have to put something on the table, particularly in terms of No Child Left Behind. That's a very concrete, immediate issue. It's not just about reforming education. It's about reforming that particular program. And I think it's going to be an important part of our domestic discussions.
Well, Julian Zelizer, thank you so much for joining us this hour. It's been a pleasure to talk with you and an interesting hour as well. So thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Julian Zelizer teaches history and public affairs at Princeton University, and he also authored the article, A New Social Contract, which was published on June 22nd in the Washington Post. I want to thank Carmen Jackson for on-air production, Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.